Welcome to Measuring Success Right, the official podcast of the Marriott Student Review, a podcast for students by students, where we connect the leaders of tomorrow with the issues of today.
Today, we have the pleasure of speaking with Greg Clark, the co-founder and vice president of the Religious Freedom and Business Foundation. Thank you, Greg.
Well, thank you for having me.
All right. Well, to get started out, could you give us a brief description of your career and how you got where you are today as far as work, education, that kind of journey?
Happy to. I guess it all started in my career as a student at Brigham Young University when I finished my mission in Ecuador.
Really?
From 1971 to 73, which dates me. I'm sorry about that. But I couldn't think of anything that anybody would want to do more than continue to teach the gospel of Jesus Christ. And so I oriented myself and took all the coursework at BYU so I could become a seminary institute teacher. And I had done everything required short of student teaching and an interview with the general authority to pass that final hurdle until I attended a devotional that was related to the inauguration of the J. Reuben Clark Law School. And in that devotional, the speaker, I believe it was the prophet at the time, made a comment about the importance of having good LDS attorneys in the church. And at that time, the Spirit bore witness to me that I was not supposed to be a seminary teacher, that I needed to pivot. And so I did. Previously, I'd also received a spiritual confirmation I needed to serve my country. Vietnam was still raging when I was a student at BYU, and both my brothers had served in Vietnam, and my dad had served in World War II, and so I felt a patriotic duty to serve my country. So upon graduation from BYU, I entered the Marines, and I served as an officer in the United States Marine Corps for 3 years, and then I went to law school. I guess everything started as a student at BYU, where I felt spiritually impressed to go to law school.
Wow, that's incredible. And well, in your time in service to the United States, did your patriotism increase? Like, what changed? What did you feel?
Well, I loved it, serving, you know, in uniform and serving my country. I remember walking across the campus and seeing the flag. And that meant a lot to me to see the flag, and I grew up in a very patriotic family, so I felt an obligation, a duty to serve, and serving in uniform only strengthened my patriotism towards the United States.
Wonderful, I'm happy to hear that. Well, do you feel like you've fulfilled the prophet's call to have a good or to be a good LDS attorney?
Well, it's interesting. In the initial part of my career, I worked for an oil company, Exxon. I started with Exxon. Mm-hmm. And eventually made my way to Occidental Petroleum. And with Occidental Petroleum, well, let me back up. Prior to going to work for Occidental Petroleum, my wife and I were living in Oklahoma, and I'd already worked with Exxon, and I was working with a real estate company. And yet, we felt a desire to want to work internationally, I guess because my wife is French and because I served a foreign mission. And I remember sending out 385 resumes,
wow,
thinking, yeah, I thought, my goodness, someone ought to be interested in my background, right? And I got 385 rejections.
Oh, no.
And because I didn't know how to do it. There is a way to qualify to work for a company internationally, and I wasn't going about it the right way. But one day, I was reading in the Bar Journal about this West Coast international oil and gas company looking for someone for their international operations. So I applied, and we interviewed with them, and it turned out to be Occidental Petroleum. And the question was, should we make that move? Should we make the move from Oklahoma to Southern California, where it'd be a lot more expensive to live? My wife would have to give up her income that she was making as a graduate student and teaching at the university. And so it was gonna cost us about 30% more to live in California than to stay in Oklahoma at the current job I had. And so we prayed about it. Should we make that move? And the spiritual impression that my wife and I both had was, you need to make that move, but it has little to do with money. It has everything to do with your ability to render greater service in the kingdom. We had no idea how that would play out, but that's what we did. We made the move. It was a leap of faith. And we suffered for the first 2 years, you know, in California until my pay increases caught up with the cost of living. And then Oxy sent us to live in Ecuador. I was their legal manager in Ecuador for 3 years. And then they sent us to live in the Middle East, in Qatar, for 7 years. It was initially a 9-month assignment. They got extended a number of times until we were ultimately there 7 years.
From 9 months to 7 years.
Yeah, 7 years. They just kept getting extended. And so, and in that 7-year period of time, I was the branch president for the church, and I interfaced with the government in an effort to try to get our church legally recognized in Qatar. And that was part of the reason we kept extending our stay in Qatar, because we wanted to see that through. And it was in that period of time that, as we were negotiating with the Ministry of Foreign Affairs to try to get the church legally recognized, that we had the opportunity to bring someone from the Office of General Counsel to assist us in our efforts with the government. And so there is a gentleman who was area legal counsel in Germany that came to assist us. His name was Elder Keith Hilbig. He was the area legal counsel. He also turned, he later became a general authority also, Elder Hilbig. But he was in Area 70 at the time he came. So he came and tried to help us in his capacity as an area legal counsel vis-a-vis the government. And I felt impressed to ask him, well, tell me about how the church is organized from the legal department of the church. And he proceeded to tell me that there's an Office of General Counsel, and there's 7 of them. And but don't worry, Greg, there's not an opportunity for you because all the positions are filled up. So you don't need to worry about a future or a career with those guys because the slots are already filled. And so I said, okay, thank you. But notwithstanding that, you know, his discouragement of even applying, I felt impressed that I needed to send my resume. The problem I had is my wife did not want me to send my resume because she was happy in Qatar as we were in our efforts to try to get the church registered. And she assumed that Oxy couldn't survive without me there. And so we needed to continue in Qatar until we got the church legally recognized. So I did what any, I guess, good husband might do. I secretly sent my resume to the church. And lo and behold, they invited us to come for an interview. And we had to pray about that. My wife felt like that was the right thing to do. We needed to give it a shot to see if the church would consider us. And so we interviewed with Bill Atkin, who's the Associate General Counsel over international legal matters, and then with Elder Wickman, who's the General Counsel. To our pleasant surprise, Elder Wickman offered us a job on the spot, subject to First Presidency approval.
Yeah.
The First President has to approve each one of those positions, area legal counsel positions. When I shared that with my kids, that I had been offered a job subject to First Presidency approval, they all laughed and said, well, okay, that's a given. You won't get that. So, but the First Presidency and their tender mercies did approve, and we moved from Qatar to Mexico and served in Mexico for 4 years. And at the time of serving in Mexico, I was responsible for the then 2 areas of Mexico, the Caribbean area, the Central America area, and the northern part of South America. They currently have 4 people doing what I did then. And so it was tough, you know, to try to handle that much. And then I guess I didn't mess up because they sent me to Lima for 4 years to manage all of Spanish-speaking South America for the church. And then following that, they sent me to Salt Lake so I wouldn't go native on them, you know, being overseas too long. And it was while I was in Salt Lake, this leads to the birth of the Religious Freedom and Business Foundation. Do you want me to cover that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So what happened then, during this 3-year period of time, while I was in Salt Lake, Bill Atkin, Associate General Counsel, and Cole Durham, who was then the director of the Center for International Studies for Law and Religion Studies at BYU. He, Bill and Cole, organized what they referred to as a 10K committee. Cole Durham often commented that his daughter had 10,000 friends on Facebook. And so the thought was, well, why can't we identify 10,000 friends for religious freedom throughout the world in various segments of society, and that we could call upon, or that the church could call upon in these different segments of society whenever the church might have a problem in a given country. For example, they had a religious section, in other words, those who are clerics or leaders of religious faiths, not just ours, but other faiths, or the academic segment. There's a segment for academia. Then there's a business segment, and I was given that. I don't know if it was because of my prior oil and gas or corporate experience or because the Lord had his hand in appointing me to that for some reason to be known in the future. But for whatever reason, I was appointed the business segment. And I had no idea as to what I was supposed to do. And they didn't either. Bill Atkin and Cole Durham often joke that they had no idea what should happen or with the business segment, other than they had received advice from Mike Young, the former president of University of Utah. Don't forget the business segment as you organize this thing. And so heeding Mike Young's call to not forget the business segment, they created a business segment and then put me in charge of it. Well, I was reading. I had no idea. I felt like Nephi, you know, not sure how to get the plates. I had no idea what I was supposed to do, but so I started researching, the business segment. And I stumbled upon this area called corporate social responsibility of the business community. And I read an Australian Human Rights Commission report on the corporate social responsibility of the business community to protect human rights. And it listed the human rights that they believed the business community should try to safeguard. And in the middle of that list was religious freedom. And it was one of those aha moments where someone literally switched on the light went off in my head that, aha, this is an angle we can pursue. We can try to persuade the business community that as part of their corporate social responsibility, they need to be defending the human right of religious freedom, advocating it. And so I collaborated with an associate who was working at the law firm of Kurt McConkie named Robert Snyder. And I asked Robert if he could help me craft a white paper. And he started working with another BYU student, and then that guy kind of fell off the face of the earth on that one. And Robert picked it up and continued, and we continued on the white paper. As we were drafting the white paper, Robert came to me and says, you know what? I found the why the business community might be willing to support a religious freedom as part of their corporate social responsibility. There's this guy named Brian Grimm who's written, a book, The Price of Freedom Denied. And I hope I got the title right. But in his book, he talks about how religious freedom is dovetailed or has a correlation with positive social economic development. And so I said, that's great. Well, fast forward, it turns out that one of Cole Durham's conferences, annual symposiums that he hosts every year, was going to feature Brian Grimm. And I learned of that. And so at one of our luncheons during this annual event, there was Brian, and I didn't know him, so I just introduced myself to him. And I said, Brian, we're writing this white paper. It talks about the linkage or the role of the business community as part of their corporate social responsibilities to advance or promote or defend religious freedom. If we finalize this white paper, would you be willing to read it? He said, well, yeah, of course. Well, about a year later, and that took about a year to finish the white paper, I sent it to him. I was shocked when he wrote me back within days, a glowing endorsement of the white paper saying, my own research has confirmed exactly what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and Brian Grimm was the world's foremost religious sociologist working at the Pew Center. Yeah, so he was a big deal. So to get his endorsement was kind of exciting. Yeah. And he said, now how are you going to advance this?
Well, so what is a white paper for?
Oh, a white paper is a research paper.
Okay.
Yeah, it's just a research paper. They're called white papers. Yeah. So it's a research, and I don't know, it was 20, 29 pages or something like that, but it was a research paper that laid out all the arguments as to why they should do it. And we cited, stuff from the United Nations Global Compact and talking about their corporate social responsibility. So Brian endorsed it. So I thought that's exciting because this guy is a world expert, world-class expert. Well, fast forward, I'm sent down to Brazil to be, do the same thing that I did in Mexico and Peru to be the area legal counsel. It turns out that on the staff in Brazil, there's an associate director of the public affairs department who's a lawyer, who's also a member of the Religious Freedom Commission of the Brazil Bar Association. Now, the bar associations in Brazil are quite a different entity than what they are in the United States. They actually matter more in that they're almost a quasi-government organization. And so they have... The Brazil government and even the community looks to these bar association committees or subcommittees for guidance on social issues. And so my colleague at work shared this white paper, this research paper on the role of the business community with his colleagues within the Religious Freedom Commission of the São Paulo Bar Association. And the members of that were from different faiths. LDS, of course, or Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, a spiritualist, Adventist, Jewish, Catholic, Seventh-day Adventist, just a whole cross-section of other faiths. Well, the commission read my report, my white paper, and they got all excited. They say, this is new. We've never seen any initiative like this, and we're going to embrace this, and we're going to run with it. So before long, they're arranging for me to speak at universities, before chambers of commerce, other groups. And it was pretty exciting. Yeah. And then the Seventh-day Adventist in Brazil have a week-long celebration for religious freedom. They're a church that is behind or in favor or as gung-ho about religious freedom as we are, as the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. They're very proactive on religious freedom things. And they're very quick to make allies with those of other faiths that have a common cause. And so they asked me to speak at various events during their week-long celebration. And I thought, you know, I keep quoting Brian Grimm in this thing. Wouldn't it be more effective if I could invite Brian Grimm to accompany me on this speaking tour with the Seventh-day Adventist? And so I did. And to my pleasant surprise, he was able to get permission from Pew to leave for a week and come down to Brazil and accompany me. All right, the funny part of this is when Cole Durham heard that Brian Grimm, who is renowned, you know, in the religious freedom community, found out that Brian was coming. He invited himself. He said, "Can I come too?" I said, "Cole, of course you can come. You're a world class guy. We would love to have you be part of this speaking tour." But I like to make fun of it. He invited himself, you know, to come. So so the three of us, you know, started this speaking engagement during this week long event. It was in between events that Brian and I brainstormed, like, well, Brian, what's next for you? What's next for you? And we talked about a few things, and even the possibility of him leaving Pew, you know, to do something with this initiative. But he wasn't sure. He wanted to make sure there was some money that could support this, but he wasn't sure what he was going to do. When he was subsequent to the Brazil visit, he went to Helsinki for some event, some major religious freedom event. And offline, he was speaking with some of the leaders of this religious freedom event about this initiative of using the business community as a new ally in the fight for religious freedom or in defense of religious freedom. And the person he spoke with, and I don't remember the name of the person, but the person he spoke with told him, this is the most brilliant idea that they've heard in a decade. You know, and that, I think, in addition to the spirit working upon Brian, motivated him to step away from Pew with zero funding, with no funding. Yeah, he stepped away. I guess he had his own savings, modest as that might have been, but it was a leap of faith. We were able to, one of my colleagues in the church who was working with Kurt McConkie was able to ask Kurt McConkie if they, on a pro bono basis, would form Brian's foundation, and they were kind enough to step up and say, yeah, we'll do that. So they formed a 501c3 nonprofit. Brian asked if I would serve as his vice president, co-founder and vice president. I asked my boss, Bill Atkin, if I could have permission to continue as a church employee, but also be the vice president. He said, of course. And so the foundation was formed. And a month later, after it was formed, Brian came down to Brazil. And through our contacts in Brazil, we were able to arrange for Brian and I and some church public affairs folks and some members of the church who, Ramena Hamor, who used to be a Congress lady in Brazil, she was in the same political party as the vice president of Brazil. So she arranged for us to meet with the vice president of Brazil. And so a month into the foundation, we're meeting with the vice president of Brazil, Michel Temer, to talk to him about where Brazil's standing was in the world as far as countries who respect religious freedom. And Brazil was number one at that time. Yeah, at that time with at least religious discrimination or restrictions. And so we met with Vice President Temer to explain the importance of religion in society and the role of the business community. That got him so excited that he started his own little speaking tour, you know, touring Brazil and informing people about where Brazil stood in the world, number one, and the role of government and the business community to advance religious freedom. We also met with various ministers and trying to find where the message might resonate. And that was a tough trial and error, trying to find which ministry might, where this might resonate, what we could do. And we met with various business people in Brazil, some prominent people, Carlos Wizard Martins of the English School. He's a member of the church, billionaire. We met with him. Francisco Valim, the very rich, wealthy member, who gave us some advice also. And well, fast forward a number of months, and Salt Lake found out or discovered, you know, some traction that this message was getting. And so Brian Grimm and I each received an invitation from L. Tom Perry to present to the Quorum of the 12 Apostles. It's called the Area Committee, but it's the Quorum of the 12 Apostles of the Seven Presidents of the 70 and the Presiding Bishopric and then others that they invite to attend. And in that meeting of the Area Committee, Elder Ballard asked me the question. He said, Greg, what pushback do you get from members of the church when you share this message that the business community should be engaged in advancing religious freedom? And by the way, that was the request of Elder Perry. Come explain to the Area Committee the role of the business community in advancing religious freedom. And so that was the topic. And so Elder Ballard's question was, Greg, what pushback do you get when you share this message? And I said, my experience so far is without fail, is that when we share this with business executives about their role, you know, as business owners or business executives to try to, you know, recruit the business community to be an ally, the first question and almost only question is, where are the senior brethren on this initiative? Instead of doing their own due diligence, they want to rely. It's kind of a lazy approach, but where are the senior brethren? You know, yeah, that's right. Where are the senior brethren on this initiative as opposed to how do I personally feel? And Elder Ballard was about to respond to my comment, and Elder Perry cut him off a little bit. And he says, you can tell these business people that the senior brethren are very excited. I mean, very excited about this initiative. And then Elder Perry said, this makes sense. This makes sense. He says, this is too important to forget. So we're going to have you come back when you're a little bit more mature, your organization a little bit more mature. When we presented before the Area Committee the first time, we only had 9 months in existence. And so Brian Grimm was subsequently invited back to make an update to the brethren on the initiative. I don't know if we'll get another opportunity to give an update on what's happening here at BYU or the exciting stuff that is really caught on with some of the major corporate, Google, Intel, American Airlines, PayPal, some of the major companies have caught the vision about what it means to expand one's, to allow one to bring their whole selves to work as part of an expanded diversity, equity, and inclusion initiative. So that is the birth of the Religious Freedom and Business Foundation. Brian will sometimes jokingly tell others that I recruited him. You know, I don't think I recruited Brian. I think somebody else did.
Yeah. Yeah. It sounds like somebody else had their hand in all of this.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. You know, from that first leading me to that Australian Human Rights Report to the white paper and the wonderful work of Robert Snyder in drafting that white paper. And I think, and Brian will be the first to tell you that he feels the Lord's hand in this whole thing. And initially, and this is kind of a delicate part, initially there was no funding. Initially there was zero funding. And Brian was living on his own personal savings for a period of time until some kind, generous members stepped up and helped fund. And subsequently, there have been others that have stepped up and other large institutions that have stepped up and helped fund the foundation because of the work that's done. And Brian's a Catholic. He's a devout Catholic. And I tease Brian because we'll sometimes, you know, we'll talk about the importance of a cardinal versus an apostle or something like the relative weight or, and without diving into theological things like priesthood authority or anything like that. I'll tease Brian and say, listen, Brian, I don't want you to convert too soon because you're opening too many doors where you are. Actually, he was able to open a door. He's opened a lot of doors for some of the brethren to speak on panels. And yeah, he arranged for, he was asked to moderate a large event, a religious freedom event, where there's going to be a cardinal in Portugal. And he approached the church as to, would the church like to have an apostle in that event alongside this cardinal, you know, to help balance. And the church responded, well, of course. And Elder Anderson was able to participate. And so Brian has been able to open doors for the brethren, you know, and the brethren, I think, have opened a lot of doors for Brian with their funding. I think the Lord's hand has been clearly in this thing from the beginning. And I think we continue to see his hand. I mean, just recently, Dean Madrian of the Dean of the Merit School of Business attended a conference that our foundation hosted in concert with the Bush Business School at the Catholic University in Washington, D.C. And she was invited to be a keynote speaker. And yeah. And she was a keynote speaker, did a brilliant job, and came back saying, we ought to be doing something like that here, you know. And so, and she was kind enough to invite us to come to BYU as visiting fellows. And in her words, to see how we can embed the initiatives that are going on now in corporate America of expanding diversity, equity, and inclusion to include faith. And so she's invited us to come here to see what we can do, to visit various professors, deans, other schools besides the Merit School, to see what can be done to embed these concepts within the BYU experience, which is what we're doing. That's why we're here.
Wonderful. Well, yeah. If you could speak like individually to students, mm-hmm. what would you say that they could do to help further the cause of religion in the workplace?
I think the important thing is that they be informed or educated that that's an option. My wife has been kindly invited to participate in a number of these management communication courses. And in each class that she teaches and shares this vision of what's actually happening, everybody's surprised. I mean, even Dean Madrian said, I didn't know this was going on until I talked to you guys. And so I think the important thing for the students is for them to be educated to know that it exists. Hopefully enough students will say, this is so interesting that this isn't a flash in the pan, and we can have this become part of our curriculum. And that's part of what we're trying to do, is to work with various professors so that the students are educated. It becomes part of their curriculum, whether it's in a human resources program, a management program, or some of these other programs, that the students are educated that this is going on. And so that when they take these courses, learn about what's going on and the do's and don'ts of standing up in an employee resource, a faith-based employee resource group, or some other faith-friendly initiative, that they can hit the ground running. And they understand that they can join these where they exist within the company, or if they don't exist, collaborate with other like-minded people of different faiths to see what they can do to help create kind of a grassroots an initiative with their own company. So the first thing I think that has to happen with students, they have to be taught. And for them to be taught here at BYU, then there needs to be curriculum on that, or conferences, or combination.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wonderful. That's a fantastic call to action.
Yeah, and they can also ask to intern, you know, with the Religious Freedom and Business Foundation. Yeah. We've already had some BYU students intern with us, and so that's an option too.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
All right. I guess what many may be wondering is, what's a hurdle that we might face in the workplace because of our religion, that the Religious Freedom and Business Foundation could help us overcome? Or what hurdle could we overcome through being informed or educated?
I think the LDS, sometimes within the LDS community, especially for those who've served missions, we're so used to teaching the truth that this is God's church, and this is the only church that has his priesthood authority. And therefore, sometimes we start to feel exclusive, you know, like we exclusively have all truth, and that it's awkward to collaborate with those of other faiths because, of course, they're not the true church. And what I learned in Brazil, well, what I learned in my mission that helped me probably in my what happened in Brazil, when I was on my mission and I was assigned to be the branch president in Cuenca, and there were no members, just missionaries, and we tried to advance the work there, it was tough. Cuenca was one of those countries up in the mountains that is very, very Catholic. And 11 years prior, you know, an evangelist missionary was hung in the town square, led by a Catholic priest who actually, you know, led a mob that hung him. And so when the missionaries, the Church of Jesus Christ missionaries appeared in the city about 11 years later, there's this kind Catholic priest named Padre Cordero. He was so concerned about the welfare of the missionaries, he walked the streets of Cuenca with the missionaries, sending the message, a tacit message, they're under my protection, they're okay, leave them alone. When I showed up years later and was trying to do some initiatives to benefit an orphanage, it was Padre Cordero who opened doors so that we could, and he would often meet with us and talk with us and help us in ways of opening up doors in the community. So I learned there that, my goodness, this church that I once thought of in a very negative way because of my reading of some passages in the Book of Mormon, I suddenly started to have a different feeling because of this Catholic priest who was so helpful and protective of missionaries years before. When I get to Brazil and I'm all of a sudden I'm collaborating with other faiths, doing exactly what Elder Oaks counseled us to do, work with those of other faiths towards a common cause, advancing religious freedom, so we have the ability to worship separately according to the dictates of our own conscience, but work together in a common cause. And so I think the challenge that some BYU students may have if they haven't had these interfaith experiences of working with other faiths is not being accustomed to working with other faiths. So you show up at work and all of a sudden you're working alongside of Muslims and you never had that experience, but you do remember 9/11. And the prejudices that arose in the minds of some people because of 9/11, or you've never worked with Catholics or Southern Baptists where you know that we've sometimes routinely get bashed, or you watch Mitt Romney get bashed in his political campaign by other faiths, other Christian faiths. And so sometimes students show up in a work environment and they're worried. How do I interact with these people of different faiths that in times I might be suspicious of, or you know, where I've personally been bashed, you know, by them. How do I engage with them? And I think that where the foundation can help in training or in curriculum that could be taught at BYU is, we're all brothers and sisters of God, like we teach in every general conference, and in a work environment, it doesn't change. They don't cease to become children, our brothers and sisters, in a work environment. They become our colleagues with whom we can work across the border to advance the company's initiatives or social initiatives that the company tackles, you know, as on an interfaith basis. And so I think that's a real challenge. I've been around LDS people who find it awkward or uncomfortable to work with those of other faiths. So I think that the curriculum of the foundation in this business school setting or across BYU, if we can get it broadly there, can help, you know, members of the church understand not just what we talk about in general conference, but what we can live day in and day out at work, that we're all brothers and sisters and we need to collaborate on that basis in the work environment also.
Perfect. Wow, that was amazing. Thank you so much.
Yep.
We're gonna wrap up today with Greg Clark with our question that we ask with every guest, and that is, how do you define success?
Great question. On this initiative, Dean Madrian invited us with an objective. Come to BYU as visiting fellows so you can to explore how you might be able to collaborate with BYU in the Marriott School and otherwise to embed. That was her language, to embed these concepts at BYU. I would define success as if we leave here and we've embedded this content at BYU, whether it be in curriculum, whether it be in an annual conference with BYU Marriott School, co-hosted by the Religious Freedom and Business Foundation and other schools of other faiths. If we can leave here and have a student body that's excited because they've heard it from Christina and her participation in these various classes, or we've got professors because they've heard it from Brian Grimm or myself or others, and they do something more than, gee, wasn't that fun? Or if it can be embedded here so that our experience here, our visit here, wasn't a flash in the pan experience, then to me that is success. If we can honor Dean Madrian's invitation to help embed, if it in fact becomes embedded, then we've been successful. If it's merely a flash in the pan and, ooh, wasn't that cute? Do you guys remember way back when these three guys came across the camp? If that's all it is, if it's a flash in the pan, then we failed. But if we can help embed it, then it will be a success.
Perfect. This has been Greg Clark, co-founder and vice president of the Religious Freedom and Business Foundation. Thank you, Greg.
Thank you.
This podcast is a project of the Marriott Student Review at Brigham Young University. You can find us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook at Marriott Student Review or online at marriottstudentreview.org.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect official policy or position of Brigham Young University or The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.